Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Vero-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez, your host, and today our guest is Emily Waddell, labor and employment attorney at Vero. And today we are discussing the Supreme Court leak and the lessons that HR professionals can learn from the recent leak of a draft opinion that was experienced by the Supreme Court. Welcome, Emily, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tani. Happy to be here.
I think unless you've been living in a shoebox with absolutely no access to the outside world, it is likely that you have heard that the Supreme Court recently experienced a leak of a draft opinion. We have not seen a final opinion in the case as of the time of recording of this show. We don't have information yet as to how the leak occurred. We know an investigation is ongoing, but we otherwise don't have information as to how the opinion itself made its way into the hands of Politico and then from there, more generally into the outside world. So, you know, the topic today, Emily, what I really want to talk to you about is how does this affect employers? And a lot of people may be saying, Tani, this is a social justice question. This is a constitutional question. This really has little to do with human resources. But are you going to prove me wrong, Emily?
I hope to. That's the goal today, Tani.
Well, perfect. Emily, you've been a guest on the show in the past, and our listeners always love to hear your insight as to the legal aspect of how we deal with different issues. But for those listeners who this is their first time joining us or simply have never caught one of your shows before, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do at Vero?
Sure. So yes, for everyone listening that I do not know or has not heard me on the program before, my name is Emily Waddell. I am a associate attorney at Vero's Labor and Employment Group. And my practice area focuses on providing guidance to businesses of all sizes as to how to comply with state and federal employment laws, as well as labor laws.
And not just that, Emily, but I think it's important for a lot of our listeners, especially considering today's topic, to understand that you're not somebody who has been a lawyer their whole career, but that you had a really interesting career beforehand and actually have significant labor experience as well, which I have a feeling may make its way into our discussion. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about life before the law?
Sure. Yeah. So before becoming a lawyer, I worked in labor relations and human resources for around 6 or 7 years and, you know, kind of got some great on the ground experience dealing with a lot of these issues, you know, on a day to day basis.
And honestly, I believe that your day to day experience really plays a huge role, especially in a topic like this, because we can sit here as lawyers, we can discuss the legal aspects of things, but really our goal is to make sure that listeners, our clients have all the information that they need in order to operate on a day-to-day basis. So with that kind of overarching umbrella of the topic, let's jump right into the topic itself. At least in our lifetime, I can't recall a situation in which a draft opinion of the United States Supreme Court has been leaked. Granted, at least during the course of my lifetime, we've seen a very significant change in how the courts operate. Not just that, but kind of from paper to typewriters to when I was clerking in the courts, the federal courts is using WordPerfect. A lot of people laugh at me when I say, you know, most of my drafting was done on WordPerfect and I had to relearn how to get onto Word. But there's been an evolution in how we practice law and similarly how the courts operate. So I think that based not only on the fact that the leak occurred, but also that the draft opinion would overturn decades of legal precedent, this situation has gotten significant media attention, and many would say rightfully so. I'd like to, however, focus the first part of our discussion at least on two questions, the how and the what. Specifically, the Supreme Court's an employer, which means that there's lessons that we as employers can learn from them based off of this, I'm going to say error. People work at the Supreme Court. They work for individual justices. We know that Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice Roberts has ordered an investigation into how the leak occurred. As of the taping of this show, we don't yet have answers to that. But like any employer who experiences a data breach, and that's what this is kind of at its core, this is a data breach. An audit of practices to find out how this occurred is important. What's most relevant, however, to our listeners, I think, is both the findings of what that audit's going to show and what we can learn from it. But what could or should the court have done to better protect confidential data and information? And with that very long-winded introduction, Emily, what should the court have done to protect confidential information?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Tani. And I do just want to kind of reemphasize what you said, which is the Supreme Court at the end of the day is an employer. So I do think that there's a lot for your listeners to really get from this conversation. So, you know, the first thing I think that's important to kind of hit on is what is confidential information? And that's going to be different across, you know, all of the different employers in the state or in the country or wherever. But I really think that the Supreme Court, you know, perhaps lacked an understanding of, you know, what exactly, or I shouldn't say lacked an understanding of what was confidential, but this certainly would fall in the bucket of confidential information, if you will. Examples of things that, you know, wouldn't, you know, fit that category are going to be something like, you know, a logo, something that the company is using to actually market to potential customers. Obviously, that's something that an employer is not going to be able to keep confidential or would have any interest in keeping confidential.
So something like the names of the Supreme Court justices or the people who are acting as legal clerks to those justices, not likely to be something that classifies or constitutes confidential information, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Similarly, the cases that are being heard for oral argument, that's also not going to be confidential information because it's publicly accessible and people have knowledge of what cases are going to be heard at least after the court itself has identified which cases it's going to hear. If the case was planning to hear a case that it hadn't indicated kind of publicly, would that be confidential information if somehow the information was going to be made public, but people found out about it sooner than they were supposed to?
You know, something like that would be a factual inquiry, I suppose. You know, I do think that, you know, just with the way that, you know, our court system's kind of set up, you know, people might have an inkling that something, you know, is going to be sent there before the Supreme Court necessarily makes a big announcement. So it, you know, if it's something like that that's going through the normal process, likely, you know, not something with a super high priority in terms of confidentiality.
And it's interesting because I completely agree with you that there's going to be a ton of situations where, specifically when we're talking about the court, that there's going to be pundits and there's going to be people who are saying, this is going to be heard. They're definitely going to take this case. And they're doing this just based off of their experience, not from some inside source. Can an employer, though, similar to the Supreme Court, can information itself be confidential up till the point in which they choose to make it public? So do they have the right to determine when information is made public?
You know, yeah, I think to a certain extent, if the Supreme Court is telling employees this is something that's, you know, private, we're not, you know, going to announce it, and, you know, this is the day that it's going to be decided and communicated, then yes, certainly as an employer, they have, you know, the right to do that.
So it sounds like an employer has some duties or obligations to at least communicate to employees and team members what is and isn't confidential information. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, that onus really falls on the employer.
If the employer only says this is confidential and somebody then shares the information, is there recourse for the employer for that breach of, I told you this is confidential, you shared it? What's the ramifications that an employer can take in that situation?
Yeah. So, you know, the tricky thing here is that it really comes down to, you know, what do the parties have in writing? Because if only, you know, left to the employer saying this is confidential and you should have known, you know, not to share it or not to publicize it, that unfortunately, you know, isn't going to be sufficient for the employer to go and, you know, try to recover for those damages. So that's really where, you know, a written policy is kind of the best course of action for employers. And quite frankly, for employees too, to have in writing, you know, what their obligations are as an employee as it relates to the employer's confidentiality.
And when you say a policy, is it something that should just be in a handbook, or is it something, should there be an agreement between the parties signed by the employer and the employee regarding expectations as to maintenance of confidentiality?
Well, you know, we're lawyers, so we want all of the writing in every form it can take. But I think the primary objective would be to have an employment agreement or some type of a confidentiality agreement that the employee is signing, reading and signing. You know, I think a standalone policy in a handbook is not going to be sufficient. It's not going to put the employee on enough notice as to what their obligations are. Although I would say if you are having employees sign an agreement, you know, the handbook can also be a good place to reference those ongoing obligations.
I think one of the reasons why this situation, especially probably to you and I, becomes so interesting is that even if there were law clerks at the Supreme Court or other lawyers who were working at the Supreme Court, and they are the ones who breached kind of the confidential nature of this draft opinion. Even though we don't sign confidentiality agreements in most situations, based off of our profession as lawyers, we take an oath. And within that oath, we promise to follow, I want a code of ethics, and other model rules of what is and isn't appropriate behavior. And one of those things is the maintenance of confidential information. You and I come into contact with highly, highly sensitive and confidential information on a daily basis, and in fact have an ethical obligation and could lose our license were we to share that information. I think as, you know, this investigation that the court is performing comes to light and we receive more information, one of the key elements here is going to be, was the breach caused by an attorney? And if so, the effect that can have, not just on their job, but also on their license more generally. If it is an individual who is not licensed to practice law, let's say somebody left an opinion on a photocopier, or they put an opinion in the trash and they didn't appropriately destroy the document before either recycle, because it was paper, if it was paper, so recycle it, then that becomes another discussion. And unfortunately, we're at that time where it's time to take a break. But after the break, I really want to get into different ways in which we can physically protect, and I say physically, but physically protect both electronic information and paper documents. So with that, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBRadio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
Being a father is an honor, a challenge, a duty, a celebration, and a testimony. I want to be legendary for you because I found everything to live for.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
In a recent survey, investors shared what they felt were the greatest threats to their retirement. It's no surprise the most common threats include stock market volatility, economic uncertainty, conflict in the Middle East. Unfortunately, there are many threats beyond your control that can affect your retirement savings. At Goldco, a leader in precious metals, the team believes one way to protect your investment portfolio is with physical gold and silver. Goldco will send you a free 1 ounce silver American Eagle coin, and all you have to do is pay for shipping and handling. No obligation, 100% free. Call 855-971-2006 to get your free silver American Eagle coin.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is Emily Waddell, labor and employment attorney of Verrill. And today we're discussing the Supreme Court leak and the lessons the HR professionals can learn from the recent leak of a draft opinion experienced by the Supreme Court. Emily, prior to the break, we were talking about the fact that an employer can define what confidential information is. An employer can determine when it's confidential and when it can be made publicly available. We know that it's best practice to have some type of policy in writing about expectations, and also that employers should have some form of a written agreement with its employees. We talked a little bit about some differences that the Supreme Court may be experiencing, but what I would love to get your opinion on is a document itself enough? Is having a written agreement with the employee enough, or should there be safeguards that are put in place within the organization to protect and to show this information is private and confidential?
Yeah, so that's a really good point, Tawny. You know, I think on the one hand, obviously, it's incredibly important to have an agreement in writing. But, you know, the reality of it is when it comes time for an employer to, you know, demonstrate that the information is really confidential and they do take those obligations that they're passing on to the employee seriously, the employer is going to need to show, you know, what steps did they take to maintain the confidentiality of the information. So, you know, if that's electronic information, are, you know, important files password protected, or is access to drive limited to only those who need to access the information? You know, just kind of basic, like good electronic security measures. And then if the information is, you know, physical, you know, printed out or physical files or what have you, how is access restricted to those documents? Are they physically, you know, locked up in a drawer, you know, in a specific room or what have you? So, you know, companies really should look to establish rules for pieces of information as well as expectations for who gets to access them and what that looks like.
I know when we have this discussion with employers, a lot of times they make jokes or they say something to the effect of, that's not how I want to operate. That's not my style. That's not kind of who I am. I don't want to be somebody who's checking the purse or the briefcase of people as they walk in and out of the office. I don't want to be electronically, you know, performing surveillance on my employees. I should have the ability to trust them. If an employer isn't checking bags and isn't checking briefcases or checking in on a daily basis as to what people's keystrokes are they still, if they have other protections in place, going to be found to have protected that data sufficiently?
Yeah, you know, I would say so. I think if there are good practices in place where, you know, this might not be the right word, but more proactive policies in place so that you don't have an employer that is, you know, checking someone's briefcase at the end of the day, but you know that you have a system in place where only certain people can access information for certain purposes, then that's sufficient, I would think, to, you know, establish that the employer does care about obtaining this information.
Now, is there going to be any identification or analysis as to the size or the financial resources available to a customer? I mean, the proactive measures that Tesla has in place, if we have mom and pop secret pizza sauce recipe that's not under the same kind of protections as our, you know, data and information created by Tesla, is that going to be problematic for mom and pa's pizza recipe when that gets leaked onto Facebook?
No, I mean, I think, you know, the courts are going to be reasonable when it comes to looking at the measures that are in place. Certainly, you know, for a small employer that doesn't have the resources or the staff, security staff available like Tesla does, the court's not going to expect, you know, that level of security for those types of items. But, you know, there are low-cost mechanisms that small employers can put in place to protect information that's important to them.
I have one more question as it relates to kind of this confidentiality topic. And that's, let's say we have a listener who, after the show is like, gosh, we don't have a confidentiality agreement in place. That's really something I should create. And on Monday, they create that document and they hand it out to employees. And they have one senior team member who says, absolutely not. I'm not signing a confidentiality agreement. You either trust me or you don't. But my my words as good as my signature. Can an employer terminate that individual for refusing to sign the document?
Yes. Yeah, certainly. You know, and I would say if you have an employee that, you know, is refusing to sign a confidentiality agreement, I'd really, you know, kind of consider that, that would be a little concerning to me. Just, you know, if you have an employee working for you and they don't seem to have an understanding of why that information needs to be kept private. So that would put up a red flag for me personally.
It would definitely put up a red flag for me as well, especially when we're having a very narrow discussion here about only a confidentiality agreement, not non-solicitation, mm-hmm. not non-compete, but truly just, this is our private data. You promised to keep our private data confidential. For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is Emily Waddell, labor and employment attorney at Verrill. And today we're discussing the Supreme Leak, specifically lessons that HR professionals can learn from the recent leak of a draft opinion experienced by the Supreme Court. Emily, I'd like to switch gears a little bit now and discuss the effect the draft opinion may be having on work environments. So, you know, in the first segment, we talked about the leak itself. Now I want to get into the content of the opinion itself. It's my understanding that some private employers have now banned the discussion of the leaked opinion at work. So really, these discussions concerning whether or not Roe v. Wade will be overturned, the effect that'll have on society, and in most situations, if an employer bans something, people take to social media to discuss the matter. So for anyone who's been on social media, I think over the course of the last few weeks, they likely saw some tweets. And I want to read out a couple potential ones that people may have seen. And then I'd love to get your thoughts as to what an employer can do, if anything, concerning tweets such as these, if their employees are participating in this tweet environment. And I know it sounds silly. Here I am like tweeting this, tweeting that. But honestly, I mean, Emily, it's something that we hear on a daily basis, social media, correct? And the effect that it has on the work environment.
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, I think people are, you know, very connected with those with whom they're working, and not everything happens in the workplace. A lot of it occurs on social sites.
Absolutely. So here's a couple of ones that I've seen. Dear at employer. And you, when I say at employer, you can insert the name of your company or any other company you know. I loved your month of posts on Women's History Month. Now would be the time to weigh in on safe and accessible abortions. Hashtag women's right, hashtag Roe v. Wade, hashtag my body, my choice. Or dear at employer, I loved last week's bottle and diaper drive for the local community center. Now would be a good time to stand up and support the idea that abortion is a state issue and not something to be governed at the federal level. Hashtag Roe must go, hashtag pro-life. Or another one, at employer, when will you announce steps you're taking to protect access to abortion? Hashtag employee benefits, hashtag women's rights, humans rights. And then finally, at employer, if I find out you're going to pay for travel for abortions, but won't let me come into work without being vaccinated, I call expletive, hashtag hypocrites, hashtag my body, my choice. So Emily, let's say you're an HR director for that employer, and your marketing team brings these tweets to your attention, because come to find out, these are all tweets coming from different employees on your team. What steps, if anything, can you take as an employer when you've been very specifically called out in these tweets?
Yeah. So, you know, I think what employers need to keep in mind here is the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act. While, you know, the impulse might be to follow up with these employees and, you know, address the behavior, the reality is that under the NLRA, employees are afforded certain protections for this type of speech. So for those of you not familiar with the NLRA, the NLRA applies to both unionized and non-union workforces. I think a lot of times people hear, you know, National Labor Relations Act and think it only applies to unions. That is not the case. And really what the NLRA protects is the employee's right to engage in protected and concerted activity. So what that means is activities that are taken for the mutual aid and protection of employees are protected. And this is something that the National Labor Relations Board and the courts interpret very broadly. So it can include activities by a group of employees or for an individual working on behalf of a group of employees. Really, you just need an individual plus one other person for the activity to be concerted. And really, these efforts are anything that could potentially improve the terms and conditions of their employment through channels, even outside of the employer and the employee relationship. So, you know, for example, an employee posting something on social media about their working conditions, that could be considered protected and concerted activity.
Emily, does it matter at all, like, when the post occurred? If I'm sitting at my desk and I made that post during work hours, is that different from me going out and having a few glasses of wine and then making one of those posts outside of the office, outside of work hours?
So certainly if the posts occur during work time, then that's going to be, you know, taken under consideration. But the other thing is, you know, if it's an employee just referencing the employer, that potentially could be covered as well. You know, if it's not referencing the employer and it's, you know, just a kind of a thought, not referencing the employer and not made during work time, then that'll be a different analysis.
So in the examples that I gave earlier, the fact that the employer was tagged in the post where it said, employer, if I find out you're going to pay for travel for abortion, but won't let me come in to work without being vaccinated, I call expletive. In that situation, if the employer hadn't have tagged their employer in the post, would that in any way be considered protected activity under the NLRA?
And the employee didn't tag them, but did reference them by name. Is that the distinction, Tani?
Well, so that's interesting. Let's say that they don't reference them by name. There's nothing in the employee's profile to indicate who their employer is, right? It just says, if I find out my employer is going to pay for travel for abortion, but won't let me come into work without being vaccinated.
So if the employer is not referenced, that would not be a protected act by the employee.
So does that mean that, you know, if an employer found that information, could they then, if they didn't agree with that stance, could they terminate the individual as a result of that speech?
You know, they potentially could, you know, whether or not that would be a good practice from a, you know, HR standpoint, I think is another question. And, you know, I'm not quite sure it would be. But, you know, I think in terms of whether the NLRA would kick in that instance, I don't believe it would.
I mean, Emily, there's the perfect lawyer answer. I would agree with you that the answer is maybe. I mean, there's a number. First, we have to presume that the employer we're talking about is a private employer, right? Because if it's a public employer, we have First Amendment kind of issues here. If it's a private employer, in most situations, employer can take action against an individual. However, there's a multitude of states that protect activity that could be political in nature. This is an issue that a lot of people do believe is fundamentally a political issue. We definitely hear candidates talking about it a lot. There's other states that protect statements or activities that occur outside of the work environment. There's states that will protect employees from action by private employers for their activities in engaging in protests or otherwise lawfully kind of standing up for something they believe in. So truly that maybe answer is really important because it's going to be super fact dependent. And with that, unfortunately, I have so many more questions concerning the National Labor Relations Act, but we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employee relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
If you're single and not dating on Match, then listen up. Match is not only number one in first dates, but second dates too. In fact, they've surveyed over 5,000 U.S. singles to get the top tips and advice when it comes to dating in 2017. Here we go. You want to impress a first date? Put your phone away. 45% of singles would be turned on if you visibly turned off your phone during a date. This is my issue, but the Mets are on it. It's like the eighth inning, and they're going to the bullpen. Millennials are 270% more likely than other generations to be turned on by someone who is binge-watching the same TV shows like Stranger Things or OA. Singles flirt everywhere, but flirting at the bar, in the laundromat, or at the gym are the most successful. I like to just say, hey, can I fold your clothes? Oh, see, now I get to, I don't know, but I would like to fold your clothes. Dating can be difficult, so if you're not using Match, you're missing out. Start searching and connecting for free today at Match.com. That's Match.com, Match.com, M-A-T-C-H.com.
With Zillow, you're not just looking for a house. You're looking for the bathroom where you'll give your kids shampoo mohawks. The bonus room you'll turn into a gym and work out in every single day. starting tomorrow. You're looking for hardwood floors worthy of your signature dance move, the Glitchy Robot.
You're not just looking for a house. You're looking for a place for your life to happen. And whether buying or renting, Zillow makes it easy with simple smart search features, photos, video walkthroughs, and more. Zillow. Find your way home.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is Emily Waddell, labor and employment attorney at Verrill. And today we're discussing the Supreme Leak. For those of you who have been living in a box or otherwise have not specifically been watching the news, when I say the Supreme Leak, I'm talking about the leak of a draft opinion that was experienced by the Supreme Court in a case that would potentially overrule the Roe v. Wade decision that has been the law of the land for multiple decades. Prior to the break, Emily and I were discussing a multitude of areas and ways in which this leak creates HR thoughts and things that individuals should be considering that that are directly related to how they operate their business. We talked about the importance of confidentiality agreements. And prior to the break, we were talking about the National Labor Relations Act and how employers can respond if an employee were to post negative things online concerning the employer's response or lack of response to this leaked opinion. Emily, can an employer have some type of social media policy that's in place that potentially could protect themselves or limit an employee's ability to post online after hours about the employer?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's certainly something that employers should consider implementing if they don't have already. You know, employers can use that policy to, you know, tell employees that they shouldn't be using their company email address or, you know, contact phone number as it relates to, you know, a personal social media account. They can identify that the employee doesn't represent the company unless, you know, obviously the employee's in a job where they're using social media on behalf of the company and it's specifically authorized by the employer. Or, you know, that the views that the employee is expressing in their posts are personal and not related to the views of the company. Companies can encourage employees to avoid false or misleading posts. Per our earlier conversation, avoid posts that disclose company confidential information and really just avoid violating the employer's policies that the employee would have to abide by at work. So whether that's, you know, intimidation, threats of violence, discrimination, harassment, or retaliation, the employer, you know, can certainly implement all of that in a social media policy.
In addition, I mean, can an employer have policies where they say you can't use personal social media during work time?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, I think you'd want to make sure that it was a blanket rule on social media usage. So it's not, you know, cool if an employee is using it for something that you like versus something that you don't like. So I would just say, you know, when it comes to rules like that, saying, you know, no social media during work time, full stop, is the way to go about that rather than spiking out certain activities over others.
Yeah, it's interesting because multiple decades ago, we would see policies that would say no personal emailing during work hours. And then that changed or expanded to limited personal email during work hours. Companies that have in place no social media during work, I think for those who are in an office setting, find it very hard to both police. And then also when they are attempting to enforce it, what we see a lot of is, well, we don't enforce it against Sally because Sally is a really good employee who works extra hours and gets her job done. But the problem is that Bill sees that Sally's on social media. So Bill thinks he should be allowed to be on social media. So any policy, I mean, I think the best policies are one that are safety related that simply say, can't have your cell phone with you on the line, or you can't have your cell phone doing this, that, or the other thing for either safety or customer service reasons. A lot harder to monitor when we're dealing with kind of office settings. And then also, potentially, if you don't want people on those sites, you can block the access, at least on the devices themselves. And then it just becomes a question of why is the employee on his, her, their cell phone during work hours? Emily, I feel like there's a ton more that we could talk about related to the National Labor Relations Act and how it relates to this situation. But I would like to jump into one third category here as it relates to the leak of the opinion and how that relates to the work environment. And I'm sure people are saying, I wonder when you were going to get to this, Tani, but it's the role of religion. Now, this is kind of going back to the content of the leaked opinion itself and the question about the overturning of Roe v. Wade and how discussions of the opinion that was leaked is titled Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. That's the caption. Can you tell employees do not talk about Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization or Roe v. Wade at work? Period. Stop. End of sentence. And let's say that we are a private employer, because I know if we're a public employer, we're going to have First Amendment and constitutional concerns. But I'm a private employer, and I'm just very concerned that if employees are talking about Roe, abortion, Dobbs, that it's going to lead to opening up a big can of worms. Can I tell people you can't talk about it at work?
So we're dealing with a private employer. So if you can recall that, you know, private employees do not have, you know, First Amendment rights like a public employee would have. So employers can limit speech as long as those limitations don't otherwise interfere with other rights that are granted under federal or state law. So the issue with a policy like you described, Tani, would be, you know, are you infringing on employees' religious beliefs or potentially setting up a claim of, you know, an environment where employees argue that they were subject to a hostile work environment based on their religious beliefs because of the restriction on dialogue?
What happens if I just have a policy that says I do not permit or allow anyone to talk about religion at work? So I won't permit anyone to talk about abortion. I won't permit anyone to talk about politics, and I won't allow anyone to talk about abortion. Can I say that?
You know, potentially. I know that's not a great answer. But I think the problem is, you know, it's such a broad category that, you know, this could potentially come up in contexts that we're not anticipating.
I absolutely agree with you. And here's one that you likely weren't anticipating. What happens if one of the religious tenets is proselytizing? And I believe very strongly in sharing kind of my opinion, and that is a tenet of my religion. Have you now infringed on my religious rights? Now, there's no First Amendment right to religion with a private employer, but is it now a hostile work environment under Title VII? It is where I really kind of wanted to get to. And that, you know, recently when we've been talking about vaccines and COVID-19, we've been talking about accommodations, the aspects of Title VII that require accommodations to be provided for individuals based off of either religious beliefs or disability status. Here, honestly, the discussion is focused more on the other aspect of Title VII, which is the creation of a hostile work environment. Let's say that you do not set up any rules or regulations concerning discussion of Dobbs or Roe. Is there a possibility that a hostile work environment based off of religion claim can be made?
I think, yeah, potentially. I think the key thing here, and as I'm sure many of your listeners have kind of caught on to as we talk about the COVID vaccines and religious accommodations in that regard, is that religion is interpreted incredibly broadly. So, someone could have potentially a religion, to your point earlier, that requires that they, speak about their beliefs or, share that with other people. And that could potentially set up a hostile work environment claim.
We're going to take a quick break, but I want to return and ask a few more questions on religion at work. But you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Hi, I'm Susan McVetty.
And I'm Pete McVetty from McVetty's Hearth and Home.
Is there a sale going on at the store right now?
No.
No Hearthstone, Quadrifier, Mendota, Wittes, Blaze King, or Morso sale?
No.
No Yodel, Vermont Castings, or Regency? Oh, there's always a Regency sale.
No.
You're telling me that out of the gazillions of wood, gas, and pellet stoves that we carry, there's not a single sale going on?
Nope.
Oh, what about patio furniture, awnings, grills, smokers, and aluminum docks?
No, just because there isn't a big sale going on doesn't mean that we're not having great deals and still doing free estimates for anyone needing a heating appliance.
Oh, well, good. Just let me know when we're having another sale.
Okay. There's always a bargain to be had if you are looking for one. And we don't need a new heating appliance.
Well, maybe my sister needs one, or my friend, or your sister.
Stop by McVetty's Hearth and Home at 893 Route 1 in Yarmouth, or check out our website at stovesofmaine.com for the latest information, including our sales.
Really? I have to check out the website? Really? And I can't believe Regency isn't having a sale.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Beryl-Law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is Emily Waddell, labor and employment attorney at Beryl. And today we're discussing the Supreme leak. Specifically, the Supreme Court experienced leak in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, where a draft copy of an opinion made its way to the public. And arguably, it's what most of the community, our society, the United States has been talking about for the past few weeks. We talked about the importance of protecting confidential information. We talked about rights employers have to either limit discussions concerning social justice concepts at work, in so much as it's tied to the work environment under the National Labor Relations Act. And prior to the break, Emily, we were talking again about religion at work, something that has definitely come into the spotlight during the course of COVID and discussions concerning vaccinations. Here, though, a lot of people are probably thinking to themselves, how is this tied to religion? Isn't it only tied to religion if you believe that Roe should be overturned and that from a religious standpoint, that life begins at conception and therefore Roe's bad law? Is that the only thing that we're protecting here?
You know, I think it's broader than that, Tawny, only because religion is defined so broadly in the courts. For example, you know, there is a religion called the Satanic Temple, and that is a religion that believes in empathy between people and advocates for justice and common sense. And the third tenet of that religion is that one's body is inviolable, subject to one's own will alone. And this organization has brought numerous lawsuits that really attempt to argue that state abortion restrictions violate their religious freedoms. So that would be an example of another religion potentially that could be impacted.
So if an employee comes to you and says, I'm a member of the Satanic Temple, I believe that only I should be permitted to take action as to matters concerning my body. So my body is subject to my own will alone. This is sounding very similar to the discussion that we had concerning COVID. Is that, would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, no, I mean, it is, but it's a very similar analysis.
So if we had two employees, one who's a member of the Satanic Temple and one who is a Catholic and who feels strongly that Roe should be overturned and that life begins at conception, and they're having a discussion on this matter, is there the possibility that an argument can later be made that that discussion in and of itself created a hostile work environment?
Potentially. I mean, remember that employers, you know, have to respect all religions, right? So you can't, as the employer, you know, maybe pick one over the other or treat one more seriously than another, you know, even if it's a belief that you know, haven't experienced before personally or, you know, are learning about for the first time.
I think one of the big things here as well is if you do hear these type of discussions occurring, you should make sure that a number of different rules are set in place. That, and when I say rules, I don't mean they have to be posted on the wall, but that you should be policing kind of the discussion. Are people treating each other with respect? Are they discussing the issues and not the people? Are they focusing their arguments or their belief system on things kind of that aren't attacking a belief structure or system? Because as soon as attacks begin to occur is when we're more likely to see hostile work environment claims. Also, after a conversation like this occurs, it may make sense for a supervisor or manager to check in with each party. I'm just checking in. Was that a discussion that you wanted to be having at work? And if they say no, I would definitely shut it down to make sure that those things don't happen again in the future. Because remember, a hostile work environment requires severe and pervasive conduct. So, you know, multiple instances of similar attacking, and I say attacking, which I think is overbroad, but similar conduct that's going to make the employee feel uncomfortable. Emily, unfortunately, I see that we're at our time. I know you and I could probably talk about this issue for hours upon hours, but I definitely appreciate you appearing on today's show. And thank you so much for all of your thoughts and insights.
Thank you, Tawny. Happy to participate.
You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.